This is Radio Boston. I'm Daryl C. Murphy in for Tisiana Dearing. There are currently more than 600 women in Massachusetts prisons and jails. That's according to state numbers. Now, that's only 5% of the total number of incarcerated people in the state, but a lot more women get caught up in the system in other ways, like when someone close to them, in this case, their children, are charged with a crime. A new book tells stories of these mothers. It's fictional, but it's based on true stories. The author, Jean Traunstein, has been an advocate for incarcerated people and a teacher in the prison system for more than 30 years. She joined us last week to talk about her new book, Mother Love. It's a conversation about what's often referred to as the criminal justice system. But at the beginning of our talk, Jean told us that experts in the field call it something else, the criminal legal system. Here's why.
There really isn't justice in a system for, let's just start with people of color.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just start with people who are poor. So the idea is that there is a system, of course. It's a legal system, and it deals with criminal issues. But we have to take the word justice out of it because there's often injustice.
Mother Love is a collection of fictional stories. Each chapter is named after a fictional woman like Marie, Rachel, and Betty. The characters are based on real mothers with children who were charged with murder and incarcerated. I first asked Jean why she decided to write it as a fictional book.
It's interesting. I went to a parole hearing, and I was blown away at the hearing because one of the mothers at the hearing stood up and asked forgiveness from the other mother,
mm-hmm.
which had never happened before. I've been to 50 parole hearings, and these are lifer hearings. And I tried to write this nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I did write it nonfiction, but I couldn't get to it in terms of the essence of the story. I needed to get deeper. And so somehow I started to imagine one of the mothers putting her hat on before she went to the parole hearing.
And you're talking about Marie.
Right.
Yeah.
I started to imagine what Marie would be feeling,
mm-hmm.
what I imagined Marie would be feeling. I started writing fiction. I mean, I wouldn't have been able to do it if I hadn't been to those 50 parole hearings.
Right.
I wouldn't be able to do it if I hadn't taught in prison for 10 years and
right.
didn't know the women. But the world that I knew came into my life, into my mind, as I wrote because I had that experience.
I would love to have you read an excerpt. We have it printed out here for you. As I read it, it hit me hard, and I feel like it set a tone for what to expect moving forward in the book. It's an excerpt that comes early on, and I would love it if you just read
sure.
it for us real quick.
This is from Rachel.
Mm-hmm.
This is at the end of the story when
yeah.
she's driving home from prison. She has no idea how she will negotiate the drive home without breaking down. But she heads out to the Subaru that Benny bought for her 40th birthday, pumps the gas, and in 2 minutes she's on the highway heading south, thinking of how all the men in her life have brought her here.
It seemed, as I continued to read the book, I said, wow, this really set me up to understand how women's relationships with men are so costly. Can be so costly in these situations, right? You know, you're dealing with abuse. You're dealing with partners who may not be as supportive as one might expect in a situation. Like I'm thinking about Marie and how her husband was kind of reluctant to show up to the hearing. And that's not to say all the men in the story were like that, right? But I feel like many of the men who took center stage in the stories just weren't, you know, were kind of harmful. You know, and I'm just wondering, how often have you seen that in your work, in your experiences?
Well, first off, I want to say that most of the children
yeah.
of these mothers, first of all, they're boys.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet they're boys. That's the first male in the book.
Mm-hmm.
They are not, although they feel incredible guilt and incredible pain, I would say that's enormous for all the mothers,
mm-hmm.
the guilt. They're not really the ones that went to prison. Their sons and one daughter in the book, they went to prison.
Yeah.
They did the crimes. And then there's the fact that there's a stigma of what they feel, and that is really from a very male-oriented society, of they did something wrong. You know, there's the embarrassment, just like one of the women, Betty, feels when she goes to the bank to try to ask for money from the bank. And the teller kind of gives her this sympathetic, you know, I'm sorry for you. There's a lot of that. The police officers look at one of the women, Nan, in the book, I'm sorry for you. You know, there's that.
It was also the mother who was kind of shamed by her community.
Oh, Shandara.
Yeah, Shandara.
Yeah, right. I think your point about the men is well said. They're struggling without a lot of support from a society that is male-dominated, jobs that are often male-dominated culturally, and then their own families.
Someone who understands firsthand is Stacy Borden. She was in and out of prison for 30 years until 2010. Now, Stacy runs a home for women leaving prison, helping them re-enter their communities. The house is in Roxbury and can accommodate up to 10 women. Stacy talks about what her work is like.
So the experience is rewarding. I mean, it's one thing that I spent time with most of the women that are starting to come out now. But it's another thing to be able to service them and really bring them into a whole different world, because most of them have served more than 20 to 30 years. And to watch them blossom and start laughing and start migrating into the community and start getting up on stage is so rewarding. I mean, it's an honor, really, to provide these services to my sisters.
We continued our conversation about the Massachusetts criminal legal system and how it affects the women caught up in it. And Stacy told us how being incarcerated affect her own relationship with her mother.
It was tough. It was tough. I come from early childhood sexual trauma, and I'm a sibling of 12, and my mom couldn't handle it. I suspect that she had to make a choice between a sibling who was abusive to a child who was being abused. And I blamed her for everything. I didn't know anything. I just blamed her for everything. And that took me into a spiral of addiction into the prison system. Mm. It wasn't until the end that I understood my mom. Mm-hmm. I had to really look at her pain. I couldn't imagine. My mother had a stroke when I first got sentenced in 1995. And in her mind, her daughter was in a prison with murderers. In my mind, I was in a prison with women who were suffering but protective of me.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my world. That would kept me back and forth. I mean, my addiction kept me back and forth, but really I felt safer in prison. And I didn't really understand the effect that I put my mother through.
Jean, I'm thinking about Marie's story in your book. Her son, Louis, gets into an altercation with his friend, ends up shooting him, and killing him.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever I read stories like that in the paper, whatever it may be, it just illustrates to me how unfortunate it is that young people in these situations where there's guns all around them and they have access to these guns, they really don't have room to be stupid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't have room to be young and dumb. And there's something unfair about that.
When we talk about those people who've killed people when they're kids, of which there are many, and, you know, we just passed this great new ruling in Massachusetts where we're finally going to give people who are convicted of first emerging adults, which is 17 to 21, a chance, 18 to 21, sorry, a chance to get out of prison. I mean, the chance to get parole, we're recognizing that they're kids too. So this whole cohort, when we talk juveniles, emerging adults, they're impulsive.
But then you have the system that discards them. I mean, that's just how our way of thinking. We've been indoctrinated into just believe that we should, the term crime and punishment. Mm. I love Marie's story. Marie's my favorite story. And when Jean first spoke about Marie, when she was in the parole hearing and turned to the mom, they were friends. They grew up, the kids grew up together.
Yeah.
And all Marie could do, all of her being, she had no support. Her husband was very angry. He might have been embarrassed. I mean, there were so many different emotions going on. But the power of this mom that said, I got to connect with the mom, not with the parole board, but with the mother. I'm going to take this opportunity and offer my apologies in love.
Yeah.
Right? This is something that Jean and I've learned from Jean. When we advocate for these parole people, for parole hearings, this is what I say at the end of, when I'm speaking for someone to come out on parole, I say that to the parole board. This is part of the restorative transform harm that they should be doing, mm-hmm. not Marie.
Big point. Really
big
good
point.
Yeah.
Yes.
You
know?
Well, I got to tell you, I met the real person whose parole hearing that was about. He's out of prison.
Mm-hmm.
I won't say his name on air. Although he probably wouldn't mind if I did, but he went through that. And his mom, you know, she's still kicking in the sense of she's a great, you know, I can't wait to meet her. But I don't think he experienced it, obviously, the way I did. It was his parole hearing. So, but the restorative justice that happened, as Justice Stacy said, that is what the parole board should be doing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that is what, not just the parole board, that is what we need in our system where people can talk to each other. And that's part of what your question was in the beginning. So Marie couldn't, my Marie in my story, not the real mother, she couldn't contact that woman.
Right.
She wasn't allowed to. That's part of what happens in Massachusetts. You're not, the family of the perpetrator is not allowed to contact the family of the victim. And I put that in quotation marks because I think she's as much of a victim as anybody.
Yeah, like she said in the story, she said, you know, I lost a son, but I understood on that day you lost a son too.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Well, Stacy, I want to come back to you real quick because I'm very interested to know, you talked to us about what your relationship was like with your mother while you were incarcerated. What was it like when you were getting out and getting back on your feet?
It was powerful. It was amazing. I mean, I had 1 year left with my parents. My dad has always been supportive of sectioning me and going to court and helping me. I don't think that my mom knew how to do that. But what she did do in the end, the last year, I just stayed committed to her last days of her life and her opening up. To really even tell me her story. I had never knew. I mean, we don't know that our parents go, you're just supposed to be my mom.
Right.
But she went through her own trauma. And expressing that to me, I found a place of belonging. And before she passed away, she finally said, I love you, Daisy. My mom was paraplegic. So just hearing that was like, what? You finally said it?
Yeah.
Was that my pain?
Wow.
Was that your pain? She didn't know how to have that connection, but we had a most powerful connection in the end.
How did hearing those stories, hearing your mother say, I love you, how did that change things for you after that?
Oh, it was profound. I just dived in. She is the most powerful black woman I could have ever had an opportunity to be in my life as my mom. I couldn't see it in my pain. I could see it, and I'm sorry I see it in her death, but she's still with me.
And how does that influence your work, helping women reenter?
I see different. Of course, I see different than what the state does. You know, and we don't look at what the transgression was. I don't. I kind of understand what happens with, well, I mean, hormonally, we're just different. And we're placed in unnatural, violent environments. Run by men. So I always say, can you imagine? Can you imagine a woman who came from sexual assault like me, and then you imprison us because we acted out from harm? it was caused to us. We acted back out. Mm-hmm. And now you're sitting in cages with a man God in you.
Mm.
So I have to look at that organically when I'm with one of our participants to know, how can I help her be nurtured? How can I help her understand accountability and responsibility and heal? Our experiences don't go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But you can develop tools that you can live naturally without causing any more harm. I mean, sometimes these thoughts are intrusive.
Yeah.
Harm becomes intrusive thoughts because you don't know what to do with the pain that you're dealing with, that you suppress so long. So the line of work that we do is to really get to the trauma, start healing, start talking about it. When we meet women like Jean Chalstein, to say, your story's already being told. You just got to tell the story and healing begins.
I want to know, what does that look like on the day-to-day? When somebody comes to the home,
yeah.
How do you begin working with them? How do you guide them through the process? And when do you know it's okay to kind of let them go into the world, you know?
I love that, Daryl, because that's just, we want to fly free, mm-hmm. right? And so it's not easy work. We start in the prison. Right now, we have a leadership series. We Zoom in every Tuesday night so the women in the prison can see the women in the house who just left them, and vice versa. And it begins there, part of the camaraderie process of feeling safe. You're safe. And so we do a lot of work. We have a theater in the basement. We do a lot of storytelling, creative writing, part of the work that Jean has always done when she was in the prison. We just extend that work.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the hope is that a woman can freely tell her story.
Right.
We believe in trauma healing, trauma-informed care, before we talk about work in housing. Right? You got to start healing. And we do that in a theatrical sense. We do a lot of one-on-one counseling. We do a lot of group therapy. We do a lot of creative writing and storytelling on the stage in the basement.
What I think is so interesting that a lot of people don't know is that, well, Stacey is remarkable, first of all. I mean, she's a woman who's been through a lot, you know, incarcerated. But she decided when she was in prison that she was going to start a house for women. Now, what's interesting about that, two things. One is that it's not uncommon, and I have a mother in the book, Shanice, who, with her trauma, she starts an organization called Healing Hearts. There are women all across the country who have started organizations to deal with and help, to deal with the trauma that Stacey's talking about and help people with their pain. I find that fascinating, and I find it interesting that there are women, a lot of women, who are doing that work.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to say
I think it's important when you just said that, Jean, to say, you know, when a woman is sexually assaulted or domestically violated against, and you have somebody else, when I met these women in prison, and you're walking the yard, and you're like, what happened to you? You don't think about what you did. It's because nobody ever talks about, we were raped.
Mm.
We were beat. Some of these women have been in the DA's office as victims before they became defendants. Does anybody ever talk about it? No one ever talks about what happens to us as to why some women can cause that type of harm.
That was Stacey Borden. She's the executive director of New Beginnings Reentry Services. And Jean Chalstein, longtime activist and educator in the criminal legal system, and author of the book, Mother Love. You can get the book through Concord Free Press, which publishes and gives books away for free.